Lunar Science. Welcome to Lunar Science, the series in which we discuss the scientific investigation of the Moon and its environment in the Artemis era. In the 1950s, artist Chesley Bonestell, inspired by visionary Wernher von Braun, painted pictures of human bases on the Moon. In many of these, astronomical observatories were depicted. Well, astronomy from the Moon is our topic in episode 22. Why telescopes on the Moon? That question was addressed in May of 2020 by Heidi Hemmel, the Vice President for Science at the American University Research Association.
The title of my talk is Astrophysics and the Moon, not necessarily on the Moon. Mauna Kea was a proving ground for the Lunar Exploration Program. Apollo astronauts training near the summit of Mauna Kea. And if we've learned nothing over the past 50 years, we'll show you that we have learned how to build telescopes in that kind of an environment, a region close to the summit of Mauna Kea. And this is an outpost 14,000 feet high, where most scientific exploration of the universe is taking place today. There are other facilities around the world, but this is quite a cluster of astrophysics. Why would we then want to put telescopes someplace else if we have such great telescopes? And this has been known for a long time that the absorption of the Earth atmosphere, of course, limits us. Ultraviolet radiation simply doesn't get down to the surface. Mid-infrared light does. Longer wavelengths of radio light do not. So this is, of course, one reason we go up above the surface of the Earth. Another reason, and that is that the Earth's atmosphere distorts our light. In space, you don't have that distortion. Now, we are also able to correct for that distortion using some tricks that I'll talk about later on in our talk. But nevertheless, these are some of the main reasons to go to space. We've been thinking about this a long time. It has some quotes from 1837, where they talk about the advantages of an astronomical facility on the Moon. And they predict that the first lunar observatory, if it's opened in 1977, that's a reasonable estimate, 140 years. We have to admire their willingness to be realistic about the timescales of lunar exploration there. In fact, they were almost right, the first telescope on the Moon, and it was in 1972. Which is very close to 1977. This was the ultraviolet camera and spectrograph, shows you some of the images that it sent back. The Earth in ultraviolet, a neighbor galaxy, the Large Magellanic Cloud in the ultraviolet. It's then been 41 years to the next telescope on the Moon. And that was in 2013, the Chang'e 3 lunar-based UV telescope. It returned some UV observations, and I have an example of some of the science there. What I want to stress for you is that in those 41 years, the aperture of the telescope on the Moon has doubled in size. The previous one was roughly 3 inches. The diameter of the primary mirror of the lunar-based UV telescope is roughly 5.9 inches, so 6 inches, call it. However, in that time scale, from that 41 years, the advances that we've been making on the ground. Now, if you hold your hand out and extend all your fingers, the distance from the tip of your thumb to the tip of your pinky is going to be a little over 6 inches. That's the diameter of the Chang'e telescope. This is the Hubble Space Telescope. It had already been in orbit for, you know, since 1990, and it's a 2 meter diameter telescope. So this is the state of the art in 2013 when we had a 6 inch telescope on the moon. So that's one reason we have a lot of back and forth about putting telescopes on the moon. The state of the art on the ground, on Earth, and in space has advanced so far during the last 50 years that it's difficult for us to imagine what we would put on the surface in the UV and optical and near infrared. I want to qualify that. It's difficult to imagine what we would need to build there. So nevertheless, we discuss it. There have been so many workshops and thinking and discussion, including where we are today, to give you a sense of how much thought has been given to this. And as you heard, it does appear in the League roadmap. This is from one of those reports. They talked about the benefits of a lunar surface telescope. But what I want to point to is that, which is about space telescopes, most of these benefits, aside from in-situ resources, are also available for our space-based telescopes. And that last time step, servicing by humans, has been crucial for the success of the Hubble Space Telescope. So the synergies are strong between the human spaceflight program and what astrophysicists want to do with their advanced telescopes in space. Gravity is a problem. Dust is a huge problem for us on the ground. And boy, I can't believe it's going to be a problem for us on the moon as well. This shows you how we clean our large ground-based telescopes with carbon dioxide washes, either by hand or robotic, and heat. Heat's a huge problem when we want to do infrared observations, which is why we're putting James Webb Space Telescope out at the Sun-Earth L2 point to give you a sense of how large James Webb is and how large its heat shields are. Those five-layer Kapton shields are the size of tennis courts. So these are all problems that we worry about. When we balance that, when the professional astronomy community balances the negatives of gravity, dust, infrared contamination, thermal variability, and the cost of trying to put things on the moon, and say, well, if we're going to spend that much money, that shows where we go. If we're going to go big for a high cost, we want to go big. We want to go big in space and the big on the ground. And on the NASA side, we're thinking of very large space telescopes. On the ground-based side, we're thinking of very, very large ground-based telescopes. We aren't really thinking about putting telescopes on the moon, but there's an elephant in the room, and many of you know the elephant in the room. I'm talking about our astrophysics community, but there are other communities, and there are other capabilities, and there are other needs, and I recognize that. There are other benefits for a lunar surface telescope, and we've discussed this already. The radio quiet capability of the lunar far side is unique in our solar system. And so you can get a presentation from Jack Burns and others about some of their concepts for these low frequency interferometric arrays on the lunar far side, and you get a continuous view of not Earth. So does James Webb. So that's not really unique to the lunar far side. There are other ideas. The Apollo retroreflectors have turned out to be very powerful tools for studying not only the moon, but to start thinking about fundamental studies of parameters of the universe. It's, you know, when we talk about things like general relativity, if we start to think about quantum entanglement experiments, I can imagine that using the moon as a base for some of those experiments would be interesting. Some people have talked about turning craters into telescopes. We've done that on the ground. That's what Arecibo is. Why not do that in space? I recognize that these are long-term goals. They don't fall into the short-term thinking we're talking about. And then the changing Earth. This is an idea that Maggie Turnbull and others have proposed of an Earth-observing telescope on the lunar near side. I think that would have some very interesting uses for using Earth as an analog for studying Earth-like exoplanets. it won't matter that it's a small telescope because exoplanets, we can't really resolve them anyway. And so being able to study the Earth in multiple phases, multiple wavelengths over very long time durations and short time durations will give us really powerful information for understanding Earth-like exoplanets. So that's very interesting. I'm just about done here. Either side, it's a proving ground for activities. I can imagine, even though the UV telescopes we might put on the lunar surface are small, it might be a good place to test the electronics that we have, qualify them for future space-based telescopes. Human engagement is powerful, always. And I really want to hammer home this next slide, which is about infrastructure. We in the astrophysics community have been thinking deeply about the infrastructure, and it will be invaluable for our future space-based observatories. Heavy launch capability, astronauts, serviceability, in-space assembly, all of those things are things that we care deeply about, and they are a core part of the Return to the Moon initiative. We just don't want the last 1% of going down to the warm, dusty gravity well that is the surface of the Earth. There's a lot of overlap. It's just like that last little bit is something that we have to have some dialogue about. I wanted to echo something that Samuel Lawrence was talking about, the intangibles of humans on the moon. And whether they're there for astrophysics or not, I think it's crucial that we acknowledge that. I get chills when I listen to the talks earlier in the day and when I see these artist concepts of what it could be like on the moon. And I know I'm not alone in that. There are many people around the world who would be so excited about this. So this is my summary. These are a summary to the questions in the previous instantiation of this workshop. What locations near the South Pole are highest priority? On the lunar far side, the low frequency radio telescopes, that's what we're talking about. On the near side, small UV telescopes that either could be proving grounds, could be used for space qualifying, detectors and electronics, retroreflectors. There may be other things as well. So either way, there's things to be done near the South Pole. Infrastructure, if you remember nothing else from my talk about astrophysics and the moon, infrastructure is keenly interesting to those of us in the astrophysics community, and we would love to continue the dialogue with those of you who are working on these aspects for the return to the moon. And with that, I'll say thank you for the opportunity to share these thoughts.
That was Heidi Hemmel, the Vice President of AURA. Visible light astronomy is not the only type of astronomy suited to the moon. We have already heard of the Apollo 16 ultraviolet light camera. Radio astronomy collects naturally occurring radio waves from the cosmos. Some long-wave signals are best detected after sunset on the lunar far side.
Thanks. So again, my name is Neil Bassett. I'm a grad student at the University of Colorado. I'm giving this talk on behalf of Jack Burns, and I'm going to be talking about the lunar far side as a scientific exploration imperative. So there's a number of sites on the lunar far side that are possibly interesting from a geologic standpoint. So there's the South Pole Aiken Basin, there's also the Schrodinger Impact Crater, but I'm really an astrophysicist, not a planetary scientist or a geologist, and so I want to talk about the potential of the lunar far side for doing low-frequency radio astronomy. And so if you take one thing from this talk, I really want it to be that the lunar far side offers a really amazing and unique platform for doing low-frequency radio astronomy. And so that's because the far side is really the only true radio quiet location in the inner solar system. So the far side is protected from radio frequency interference from terrestrial transmitters on Earth. It's also free of ionospheric contamination, which can plague Earth-based low-frequency experiments. And it's also going to be protected from Earth's auroral kilometric radiation below about half a megahertz. So although the far side is protected from radio frequency interference, it's not truly perfectly radio quiet. And that's because radio waves at these low frequencies are going to diffract significantly around the edge of the moon. So a couple years ago, we published a paper in which we performed some electromagnetic simulations of the interaction between radio waves in the lunar environment and specifically tried to look at how far they would diffract around the edge of the moons. And so for a lot of these radio astronomy experiments, it's not so important the exact location or site where we do them from. Really, it's just important that you're inside a level of attenuation of RFI that's sufficient to make your observations. So now I'm going to talk about a couple of specific experiments that our team is involved with. So the first is Lucy Dapper. So this is the combination of actually two kind of different antennas. So the first is the Lucy experiments. Lucy is composed of four STACER antennas. Lucy is led by Stuart Bale at Berkeley, and it's currently manifested for flight on a PRISM mission to the Schrodinger crater on the far side in 2025. So Lucy's primary science objective is to probe the plasma and dust environment on the lunar surface, but we're currently under discussions with the Lucy team to fly our Dapper instrument as an augmentation to Lucy. So Dapper is the square patch antenna on top of the spacecraft. And so what Dapper will be able to do is extend Lucy's frequency range to higher frequencies. So that with the combination of these two instruments, we'll be able to observe from 10 to all the way to 110 megahertz. And so what this will allow us to do is make cosmological observations of the redshifted 21 centimeter line. So this will allow us to probe a period of the universe called the Dark Ages, which is corresponding to the first formation of large structure in the universe. And it will also allow us to study a cosmic dawn, which is when the first astrophysical objects started to form. I want to talk about another mission, which is kind of longer term, called FARSIDE. So in this case, FARSIDE is an acronym. And this is a probe class mission to lay down an array of 256 dipoles directly on the lunar surface. So whereas Lucy Dapper will only be able to make very low resolution measurements, with this array of antennas, we can actually make maps of the radio emission on the sky. So these dipoles will be laid directly on the regolith using these axial rovers that you see. And so again, we'll be able to investigate the Dark Ages in more detail, which is one of the discovery areas in cosmology that was identified by the recent 2020 Astrophysics Decadal Survey. We'll also be able to image radio emission from CMEs, from the sun, and we can also potentially study magnetic fields of exoplanets and the role that they may play in planetary habitability. So thanks.
How would such a lunar radio astronomy telescope be constructed? In October of 2020, Mason Bell of the University of Colorado in Boulder set out this plan.
Okay, well, my name is Mason Bell, and I am working at the University of Colorado with Phaedra Curlin under the direction of Jack Burns. And we are here today to talk about the construction of lunar infrastructure, leveraging VR and AR telerobotics. So this work directly aims to support the lunar mission FARSIDE. However, we are considering the deployment of all lunar infrastructure, specifically enhancing teleoperation. So FARSIDE is a NASA-funded concept mission that aims to deploy a low radio frequency radio array on the far side of the moon. This array would act as a lunar telescope that can characterize unclassified wavelengths as well as SCP and CME events in other solar systems, as well as characterizing magnetospheres of foreign bodies. So the lunar FARSIDE acts as an ideal location for this array due to its area of radio frequency interference silence. So FARSIDE will directly require mobility specifically for the deployment of the radio array. Currently, goals include a lunar lander that would deploy the rover onto the lunar surface. From there, the rover would be responsible for deploying all of the antenna diode pairs, as well as all of the cabling between the antennas. So this brings us into a couple of the requirements for mobility required through FARSIDE. There will be 128 antenna node pairs in total. They will be deployed in a four-arm spiral pattern over 10-kilometer diameter. With this in mind, each arm could probably have one rover deploying all of the antenna nodes, which would include about 32 pairs per arm. So the JPL team has created the Axel rover, which acts to lay down polyimide tether, which would act similarly to the applications of FARSIDE, where we would need to lay down cabling between all of the antenna nodes. The robot would also require housing that could hold each of the antenna nodes responsible for, as well as some sort of system to deploy them. So this deployment process will be mainly acted through autonomy. However, As these robots are traveling over long distances and rough terrain, there will surely be points of autonomous failure. So we're really looking into the teleoperation that will be enabled through the Lunar Gateway and how we can enhance the operator response to autonomous failure. This is something that we haven't really been able to do before, as we haven't had a lot of real-time communication with too many surface assets. On top of all of these requirements, lunar farside survivability is obviously a big concern. Can it survive through the night? Can it handle the rough terrains? And can it handle the climate changes? So, like I said, we're specifically looking to enhance astronaut teleoperations, specifically at the point of autonomous failure. While these robots may be acting on their own, at the point of failure, we actually have a little bit of wiggle room to be able to allow some human-robot collaboration and let the operator step in and take over control of the robot. This is something we really haven't been able to do with robots on foreign bodies. For example, the Mars rover, which requires long chains of communication, is controlled through command sequencing, where we tell it what to do. Once it gets that message, it acts it out and sends us a response. So this response is usually coming in the form of a lot of stereo images, which we can use to see the current state and environment of the robot. So when the Mars rover runs into a problem, we use the Mars Yard, which is a physical duplicate of the Mars rover, as well as an environment space that we can use stereo images to recreate the current problem, state, and environment. And then engineers on the Earth's surface can then implement and develop solutions that they can send back to the Mars rover. So one way that we can enhance some of this astronaut teleoperation is through telepresence. Stereo imaging provides depth, which is something that we haven't really used in high levels of teleoperation before, but we know that it improves situation awareness and lowers cognitive load. These stereo images can also be used to recreate spaces virtually.
The most recent addition to the astronomers and cosmologists' arsenal of instruments is the gravitational wave detector. Could a gravitational wave antenna be set up on the moon? Jan Harms of the Gran Sasso Science Institute thinks so.
So what is this about? The measurement principle is the following. Gravitational waves that are, for example, generated by binaries of black holes and neutron stars, white dwarfs, they, when they pass elastic bodies, like, for example, the moon, then they will excite vibrations, quadrupolar vibrations. Quadrupolar vibrations, that is connected to the nature of gravitational waves. So these are quadrupolar waves, and they excite quadrupolar vibrations of elastic bodies. Now, these vibrations can be monitored at the surface with what I would call inertial sensors. Inertial sensors is something like, for example, a seismometer, a gravimeter. You might know it under different names, accelerometer. So this type of sensor can then monitor the surface vibrations produced by gravitational waves. Now, this idea is quite old. Joseph Weber, who was one of the founding fathers of the experimental gravitational wave detection, he got famous for the resonant bar detectors, a lab scale experiment that exploits the same principle. But he was also the first to actually search for gravitational waves by monitoring vibrations of Earth. And he was also coordinating an experiment called the Lunar Surface Gravimeter, which was brought to the moon by the crew of Apollo 17 in 1972. Now, that experiment was meant to monitor vibrations or detect vibrations caused by gravitational waves. Now, today we also know that gravimeter was not sensitive enough, that technology was not good enough to see gravitational waves. In hindsight, we know that. But at the same time, this experiment failed due to some flaw in the design made by the company Lacoste and Romberg that was responsible for the construction of this gravimeter. But okay, nonetheless, we didn't really lose any gravitational wave science there because the sensitivity was anyway not enough. But the idea is very good. I mean, why did Weber think at all about the moon? He thought about the moon because the moon was expected, and at that time already known from other Apollo missions before, to be extremely quiet seismically. And so that is exactly the condition that you need to find these tiny vibrations that would be caused by, or that are caused by gravitational waves. Okay, so then we can now step ahead to 2020. So last year there was a call by ESA for ideas. What science could be done now in the near future or brought to the moon, essentially, with the European Large Logistics Lander? And we submitted our idea, the lunar gravitational wave antenna, then at that time. And what we proposed is essentially to deploy an array of four inertial sensors, you know, call it inertial sensors, seismometers, perimeters, whatever you want. This is all the same type of instrument. And in a kilometer scale array. So on the moon, it is so quiet that even the very sensitive seismometers that were brought to the moon with the Apollo missions were not able to see this background noise. What they observed were, of course, moonquakes, meteoroid impacts, all of that, but these occur relatively rarely, you know, or with minor magnitudes. So this would essentially reduce a little bit the time you would be able to search for gravitational waves, but they are not adding up. So as far as we know, at least, they're not adding up to a significant background level. That means something that is continuously present that would set essentially a sensitivity limit to our search for gravitational waves. Now, but even if there is some limitation due to seismic disturbances, we propose this array of four seismometers for a reason, because with that array, you would be able to distinguish, to some extent at least, not perfectly, but to some extent, you would be able to distinguish between seismic events from moonquakes and meteoroid impacts, for example, and gravitational wave signals. So that is, for that reason, an important part of the experiment. I was already indicating that we would like to have the deployment in a crater. So not any crater, we would like to have it in a permanent shadow. And this has to do with the technology that we want to use. Now, today, this might not be true for the future, but today we believe that we cannot achieve the sensitivity with our instruments at higher temperatures. Let's say, you know, 100 Kelvin, 200 Kelvin. We believe this is not cold enough for our instruments to achieve the sensitivity that we need to see gravitation waves signals. So we need to cool these instruments down essentially to 4 Kelvin, and we would greatly profit from a natural environment that is already at cryogenic temperatures. It turns out that at the south and north pole of the moon, there are shadows, and in some of them, there are even doubly cast shadows where there are craters inside craters. But in any case, inside these regions, there are some points where the temperature can get extremely low. It can be continuously below 40 Kelvin, for example. And this is an ideal environment for us. So this will essentially offload a lot of work for us to get from then something like 40 Kelvin to 4 Kelvin. So the cryogenic system would be quite simplified in this case. Now, the other advantage just to point out is that in a permanent shadow, you also do not have events that are thermally induced. So the Apollo seismometers, they observed many small events that were had a thermal origin, where some temperature changes, for example, at the surface induced some stress and strain in the surface to cause then tiny events. And these can also be avoided in such a permanent shadow. Now, if you deploy in a permanent shadow, of course, then you have other challenges to overcome. And the main challenge is to get power to your experiment. And there are, in principle, two options. You can use nuclear power. This is a bit costly, first of all. Then you have safety concerns, of course. And then from the European perspective, you have at least the constraint that ESA has not used them in the past and might not use them in the future. So then the other option is that you can bring power into your permanent shadow with laser power beaming, for example. So then you would here have solar cell cells here somewhere in the sunlit part of the rim of the crater, for example. And then you would beam down, you know, we would convert that into essentially a laser beam, and that would shine onto a receiver panel and convert it back into electricity. And this is another way to do it. In fact, I am currently having most contacts with industry to understand what is the state of the art at the moment, you know, how far are we from realizing such a system? And with a total consumption that we estimate at the moment of maybe 200 watts of the entire experiment, It seems that we are that this is quite feasible to do, but of course not ready yet. There's no system ready for such an application yet.
Jan Harms of the Gran Sasso Science Institute